Okay, so this is Bio 160, and it is Thursday, September 4th, and I think we have a test a week from today, is that right?
That is correct.
That's a test.
No, it's Tuesday.
It's Tuesday. Oh, next time. I'm glad I'm checking with you guys. Okay, so it's going to be on Tuesday, and let's see, what chapters are going to be on there? Who's got a syllabus? Let's double check. 1 through 3. So 1, 2, and 3, and we're almost done with chapter 3, but not quite, but we'll be done with it today. And don't forget, you got a quiz on chapter 3. So you've had a test, a quiz on chapter 1, a quiz on chapter 2, and you're going to get a quiz on chapter 3. So you know what? You're going to have quizzes over all the material that you're going to have a test on. So you shouldn't be too anxious, but you still have to prepare. You still got to study a little bit. Oh, yeah, after lecture I'll get it. Yeah, sorry about that. Or maybe during the quiz or something. So good things to study for the test. What, the student study guide? Like how you prepared for the quizzes? Go over those questions another time. Go over the instructor study guide that I have at the end of the notes that I pass out in class for you. And don't forget the exam figures. You should be able to relabel those exam figures 100%. Okay, and then if you do that, then you should be able to do really well on the test. But it's going to take a little effort to study to get to that level, right? Yeah.
Where's the table 2 and 1, columns 1 and 2? So that's, because it says 2.1 and table 2.1. Is that the same thing? On here, you have 2.1, then table 2.1.
Oh, that might be figure. Only if it's a table do I say table. So probably figure 2.1 as well. Okay.
And the columns, just 1 and 2 on
table. On that table, just the first couple of columns. I don't have a picture of that table to show you.
Okay.
Because I think maybe the third column is the abundance, the percentage found in your body, and I don't want you to memorize the percentage of those different elements or chemicals that are in your body.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so we were talking about transport processes in the body, and there are two main kinds of transport processes. There are active processes and passive processes. Which ones require energy?
Active.
Active. Active requires energy. And guess what the form of that energy is? What does it need? It needs ATP. Right. So a passive process does not require energy, but a molecule can only move in a certain direction if it's moving passively. And it's driven by the concentration gradient. Which way does a concentration gradient have to go in order for something to move passively? Well, I don't know about left to right. It could go from top to bottom, forward to back. All right, but in terms of concentration gradient, how do things always move passively? From high concentration to low concentration, right? Like my car that I drew on the board. It will go passively what? Downhill. That's how it would get it started sometimes. Right, so that just means there we go. That's helpful. All right, so passive process, a good example of a passive process is diffusion. So a molecule will move from high concentration to low concentration without the use of ATP. All right, osmosis is a special kind of diffusion. It's only pertinent to one molecule in our bodies. So sodium can't osmose, glucose can't osmose, proteins can't osmose. They might diffuse down a concentration gradient, but the only molecule that can osmose is what? The solvent molecule? The solvent. And what's the solvent of our bodies? That is water. So water is the molecule that can osmose, nothing else can. So don't get tricked by that. So osmosis also has another criteria. Osmosis is diffusion. It's a water molecule that's moving. But there's a third criteria. There has to be a membrane involved. Water has to move across a membrane. And in particular, that membrane's got another special characteristic. It has to be semi-permeable, selectively permeable. And as we were ending class last time, I drew three different solutions that had red blood cells in it, and the red blood cells could stay the same shape or shrink or blow up depending on what the salt concentration was of the solution that we placed them in. So the membrane that surrounds that red blood cell is a selectively permeable membrane because it doesn't let salt through, but it lets water through. So that's why that cell would change shape, because the salt is trapped inside of it and only water can go in and out. So what kind of solution causes crenation? The hypertonic solution causes crenation. And I don't have crenation on your study sheet right here, so you should probably pencil that in. Right, crenation. But what does crenation really mean? What does crenation mean? Shrinking. When the cell shrivels down, the water is being drawn out of it because you put it in a salty solution. All right. What kind of solution causes hemolysis? That would be that hypotonic solution. Hypotonic. And a hypotonic solution, a good example would be pure water, for instance. And water is going to move down its concentration gradient from high outside the cell to not so high inside the cell. And as water moves in, the cell is going to expand, even so much that it's going to explode. That explosion is what we call lysis. And since it's a red blood cell, we call it hemolysis, but we don't pronounce it like that. We say hemolysis, right? Hemolysis. That's blowing up of that red blood cell. That's in a hypotonic solution. Another kind of passive process is what we call facilitated diffusion. And there might be a molecule that can't move across the membrane all by itself. All right, but if there is a special little protein inside the cell membrane, then that molecule can move from high concentration to low without the use of energy. So what do we call that when something moves from high concentration to low without the expenditure of energy? What do we call that? That's diffusion. But if it needs a carrier to get across the membrane, then we call that facilitated diffusion. So let's see if I can find a picture of what that actually looks like. So here we have, what is this stuff?
Phospholipid.
That's a phospholipid bilayer. That's how you describe any kind of membrane. All right, but membranes can have proteins embedded in them because a membrane, we can use a model of the fluid mosaic model to describe a membrane as well. The phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, but we can add stuff to it to give it certain properties. And in this particular case, the property is transport of a molecule. So we see these little blue molecules right here. They can't get through the membrane by themselves, even though it's high. Can you see it's high concentration outside the cell and low inside the cell? So which way will these molecules want to move by diffusion? From outside to inside, but it can't get through the membrane. But if there's a special carrier protein embedded in the membrane that will allow the molecule to go across, then this molecule will move just by diffusion through the membrane, down its concentration gradient, from high concentration to low. But it needs this protein in there, so we call this facilitated diffusion. And still, you don't see any ATP being used. This protein just changes shape a little bit. It kind of acts like a teeter-totter, and it kind of sucks up a molecule, and when this molecule is in here, it changes shape, and then it releases it to the inside of the cell without the expenditure of ATP or energy. And the only way that can happen is if this molecule actually goes from high concentration to low. Then you don't need ATP right there. Okay. So that's a pretty good example of facilitated diffusion. Filtration is the last one. And I don't have any pictures of filtration, but maybe most of us have used filtration this morning on the way to work or school. And that's when we take some filter paper and some coffee grounds, right? And we make coffee and we pour water on top of the coffee grounds. And where does that water do? It goes through the coffee grounds and then it goes through the filter paper and ends up in a little jar underneath, right? And it has taken with it some of the coffee. But what? Only the little small pieces of coffee, right? The big grounds get stuck in the filter paper. And so our bodies filter stuff pretty much the same way, not with filter paper, but with little membranes that have holes in it that allow small molecules to go through, but not what kind of molecules? Large ones. The large ones are left behind, just like the large particles of coffee, they're left behind too. All right, so that's filtration. And In order for that fluid to move through your coffee filter, did you have to do anything special? No, all you had to do is pour the water on top, and gravity does the rest, right? So again, that's a passive process. That didn't require energy to do that. All right, let's look at some active processes. Active just means requires ATP, but something special can happen if it's an active process. Not only can something move from high concentration to low, but actually these molecules can move from low concentration to high. So in terms of the analogy of my car, which way would my car be going?
Uphill.
It would be going uphill. That requires energy. That requires gasoline in my car to do that. But in a cell, what is it going to require? Gasoline won't work. ATP. It needs ATP for that to happen. So an active process is low to high concentration, but ATP is required. ATP is broken down in this particular process because in these bonds that make ATP, there is a lot of energy, and when we break them, that energy is released. So the molecule that's formed when ATP is hydrolyzed is adenosine diphosphate. That means there's two phosphates on it, and that third phosphate right there is just free to float around inside the solution someplace. But that energy then is released, and it can be used by your cell for instance, molecular transport. Let's take a look at another slide. Let's see what I got right here. Okay, let's take a look. Here's a pretty good slide. So here we have the cell membrane again, that phospholipid bilayer. And here we have a particle that's what? Inside the cell. So here's inside, here's outside. And we have another protein embedded in the membrane. And let's just say that this is the high concentration of this particular molecule and this is a low concentration of it. This molecule won't go all by itself up into this higher concentration. You need to expend ATP to do that. So this has to be coupled with ATP somehow. So how would I want to diagram that? All right, so this molecule might move into the protein, but in order for... that's why they have this marker right here. It's going to fall off. Okay. In order for this protein to change shape, notice that this shape here, the top one, is different than the bottom one, right? Because the top one, this little tunnel, is like open to the inside of the cell, but the top one, the tunnel, is open to the outside of the cell. In order for this protein to change shape, ATP has to be bound by this protein, and what would be the result? ADP plus what? Inorganic phosphate. Am I off the screen? Yeah. Inorganic phosphate plus that energy, and that energy will be used to change the shape of this protein right here. So now the particle that's in the middle of it can go to the outside of the cell. So this would be an example of active transport, of molecular active transport. So who could tell me why this is active transport right here? Because we see it requires ATP, and the molecule is going from low concentration to high concentration. So that's got to be active transport, not just a passive transport. Okay. All right, there's another kind of active transport, which we have on our slide right here, just besides these molecules. All right, this is for large particles and maybe even cells, or large particles as big as a virus, for instance. It can be taken into the cell by forming of a vesicle at the cell membrane. Moving of the cell membrane, making a pocket in the cell membrane, for instance. So, here I got a couple slides showing that. So here I've got a cell right here, and there's that nucleus and the nucleolus inside there, and the membrane is nice and smooth. But here is a particle that's outside the cell. And the cell realizes that it would like to import it inside the cell because maybe it has some important building blocks or it has some energy value to the cell. And this particle is way too big to diffuse across the membrane, right? Way too big. So what happens is that the cell forms a little dimple on the surface. It's moving the membrane around by pushing on microtubules and intermediate filaments and things like that. And it pulls in the membrane, right? And it surrounds the particle. And then the membrane forms a bridge over this region of that dimple. And it forms what? A complete circle or a complete vesicle around this particle. And then it breaks off and this particle ends up inside the cytoplasm, inside of a vesicle inside the cytoplasm. So this would be an example of what we call phagocytosis. Cytosis just means a cellular process, and phago just means eating, right? So this just means cell eating. The cell has eaten this particle because now it's inside the cell. And this particle can be digested. What kind of organelle digests things inside the cell? A lysosome. So a lysosome over here could fuse with this vesicle, and then this particle is going to be digested down into its building blocks, and those building blocks can be used to make proteins or lipids or other components that the cell needs. Yeah.
Is that vesicle made the outside membrane of a phospholipid?
You know what? Almost every single membrane inside the cell, and even the cell membrane, has that basic structure of a phospholipid bilayer.
Okay.
And that's why it's so easy for these things to pinch off, or even the reverse process we're going to see. Okay, so all of these membranes around the nucleus, around the mitochondria, endoplasmic reticulum, the cell membrane, is all the same material. It's a phospholipid bilayer. All right, so it's a really nice membrane, and nothing ever had to be invented that was any better or different. The only thing that these membranes might differ in is the kinds of proteins that are embedded in it, and antigens and things like that. The membrane is identical, so membranes can fuse together very nicely. And probably, maybe you've seen this, sometimes you can buy a little bottle of a soap solution and a little ring you stick in the bottle, right? And you get that soap solution on that ring and then you wave it around in the air. I should actually buy some. And you form these bubbles and the bubbles float around, right? And so think of that soap solution as being a membrane, like a phospholipid bilayer. And each bubble that's floating around is what? Has the exact same membrane. It's just a soap film. And when they touch each other, sometimes they pop. But every once in a while, when they touch each other, what happens? They just fuse together. They go boop and form this big bubble. And that's because, why? The soap film is exactly the same on every bubble. The same thing happens with these membranes. Since it's the same structure, these things can form and flow together, or they can separate very easily too. Because this membrane is the same as that membrane right there. Oh yeah, here's an example of a lysosome that I drew in one time, breaking down that particle right there. Well, so this is phagocytosis. A cell can also do this for fluid. Maybe you don't have a particle there, but the cell wants to take in a lot of fluid, for instance, and put it inside of a vesicle inside the cell. If it's fluid, we call this pinocytosis. So phagocytosis is cell eating. Pinocytosis is cell drinking. So that's pretty easy to see. And cell drinking and cell eating, both of these together can be characterized with another name, which we call endocytosis. Endocytosis is an example of bringing material into the cell. Endo bringing into the cell. And exocytosis means that it's going to be the opposite process. It's going to be the cell actually secreting something to the outside world. So it's the opposite of phagocytosis or pinocytosis. Okay, so it's going to go from inside to outside. So what would that look like? I suppose I would just turn this slide backwards. Let's just say that we have a cell with a vesicle on the inside. And then that vesicle is brought over to the cell membrane, and when it touches the cell membrane, what's going to happen? They're going to fuse together, and then whatever on the inside of this vesicle, right, will have a pathway to the outside world, and it ends up in the outside world. So it's being secreted from the cell. So this particular process of this particle ending up on the outside is exocytosis. So that would be an example of how cells can secrete something like hormones or mucus or something like that that shouldn't be inside the cell but outside the cell. Now, here's a good question for you. If this is exocytosis, here we see a particle inside the cell, inside that vesicle, but it ends up where? On the outside of the cell. That's exocytosis. Is that active or is that passive? It is active. Anytime you have to move these membranes around inside the cell or these vesicles, it's got to be an active process. So what molecule is being used to move this vesicle around?
ATP.
ATP. That's right. So any kind of vesicular transport inside of a cell, right, is going to be active. And that means that things can go from low concentration to high, but it also means that you have to have ATP for that to happen, the energy source. All right, so that's membrane transport. Who's got any questions on that? Any questions on that? No? So far, so good? Okay. Well, let's continue on a little bit with protein synthesis. What kind of organelle is necessary for protein synthesis? Ribosomes, that's right. Ribosomes don't have any membranes on them. They're just a small, tiny particle inside the cell. They're necessary for protein synthesis. There is a membrane inside cells that sometimes is smooth. It doesn't have any ribosomes on it. We call this smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And what's the function of smooth endoplasmic reticulum? Lipid synthesis, right? But if you have smooth endoplasmic reticulum and you put a ribosome on it, now what can it do? It can undergo protein synthesis because it has that ribosome. Okay, so ribosomes are important for protein synthesis. Well, how can we make a protein? So here we have a protein. There are a couple steps that are necessary in order for that protein to be made. And this is just the central dogma of biology. This just illustrates how information flows in cells. So there is information in a protein. And there's information in a cell that determines how to build that protein. That information is stored in DNA. Where do you find DNA again? Inside the nucleus. And that DNA makes chromosomes. It makes up chromosomes. So chromosomes are the blueprint on how to make a cell. But not just a cell, but all the cells in your body. So those chromosomes actually are the blueprint on how to make your particular body or my particular body. That's in DNA. That's protected inside the nucleus. So DNA never leaves the nucleus, but that information has to be used in the cytoplasm by those ribosomes in order to make a protein. So how does that information get out of the nucleus? Well, first, DNA, or the information in DNA, is converted into information in RNA. And then that information is converted into that protein right here that we see. So how many step process is that? Okay. Well, I see three molecules, but how many arrows do I see?
Two.
I only see two. Since you see two arrows, that means it's a two-step process. Plus, you could tell me something else. What about those arrows? Are they pointing in one direction or both directions? Is it a bidirectional arrow or a one-way arrow?
One-way.
And are both arrows pointing in the same way?
Yes.
So this is, so protein synthesis is a one-way street. You always start with DNA and you end up with a protein. That's a one-way street. And it can't go backwards. That's what the central dogma of biology says. It says that the information in DNA always flows from DNA into proteins, looking at these arrows right here, and never the reverse. Right? So it's DNA that directs the production of protein. Proteins in our body don't direct the building of DNA. That does not happen. So that's really a good thing. You want to know why I think that's a really good thing? Because, for instance, when you go home tonight and have a nice chicken dinner or something and you eat all that chicken protein, you don't have to worry about waking up with a beak and feathers in the morning. Because when you eat a protein, it cannot affect your DNA. It can't go backwards. right? So who you are is in the DNA inside your nucleus. That determines your proteins. The proteins that are in your body can't determine who you are, okay? And that's due to that central dogma of biology. All right. Did we talk about the building block of a protein? What's the building block of protein?
Amino acid.
Amino acid. You probably knew that before you took this class. But what's the building block of RNA? Nucleotides. What's the building block of DNA?
Nucleotide.
So you got nucleotide for DNA, nucleotide for RNA, and for protein, amino acid, something different. Okay. So let's look at the two steps that are necessary. The first step is what we call transcription. And transcription, okay, happens inside the nucleus because that's the only place where we find DNA. That's where we find chromosomes, inside the nucleus right here. So transcription is the process which copies the information in DNA and puts that information into RNA. This occurs in the nucleus and never in the cytoplasm because we never find DNA inside the cytoplasm. So it's got to happen inside the nucleus. And we've got a couple different kinds of RNA that are made. There's a ribosomal RNA. That's the easiest to appreciate because ribosomal RNA actually makes up the ribosome. And what's a ribosome? Do you have a picture in your mind of what a ribosome looks like? It's that tiny little dot inside the cell. That's the workbench that makes proteins. Okay. Then another one is a transfer RNA. I like to think of that as like a taxi RNA. That's bringing the basic building blocks of a protein. What are the basic building blocks of a protein again? Amino acids. Transfer RNA brings amino acids to a ribosome so that they can be put together to make a protein. That's what the transfer RNA is. And this messenger RNA is the sequence of RNA nucleotides that determines what the sequence of amino acids in a protein should be. So that's what we call the message. That's the instructions on how to put that protein together from the basic building blocks from amino acids. All right. The second step is translation. So you got to know transcription and translation. They're really big words. How are you going to memorize which one comes first? I just memorized this back when I was in school, but it's a lot easier to understand it. Okay, because what does transcription really mean? For instance, if you apply to another college someplace, they might want to take a look at your record here at Cypress or other colleges. And what are they going to ask you for?
Transcript.
A transcript. And what would that transcript be? It's a record of what you've done, but it's basically going to be what? A photocopy of your record that's in admissions and records. That's why they call it admissions and records, because it's a recording of your grades, right? So they're going to get that piece of paper, photocopy it, and either give it to you or mail it off or something. That's what you call a transcript. So how much different is that transcript from the actual record? Is there any difference between them? It's really an exact copy, right? And you're not changing languages, right? It's going to be an exact copy of your record here at Cypress College. So this first step of protein synthesis we call transcription because this RNA is basically a photocopy of the DNA. It's an exact copy. So what's the building block of DNA?
Nucleotide.
What's the building block of RNA?
Nucleotide.
So it's going from a language of nucleotides to a language of nucleotides. There's no change in language right there. Right? It's like a photocopy of the information. And then that RNA leaves the nucleus and it goes into the cytoplasm. And when something's in the cytoplasm, like RNA, it can be damaged. And it can get lost, and then it's destroyed. All right, so just think what would happen if the DNA was able to get into the cytoplasm. It could get damaged or destroyed. And then what would happen to the cell? It would die because that's the basic information that controls the structure and the function of cells. So cells make a copy of the DNA so that that copy can go into the cytoplasm. And if that copy of the DNA gets lost or destroyed, is that such a big deal?
No.
Not such a big deal because why? You still got DNA in the nucleus and you can make another copy of it. No problem. So that's the beauty of transcription right here. It just helps protect the DNA, but it allows the cell to get at that information to find out how to build a protein that the cell needs. So transcription is like a photocopy, going from nucleotide language to nucleotide language. All right, so now we got these RNAs. They go into the cytoplasm, and that's where the second step takes place. We call that translation. So translation occurs in the cytoplasm and never in the nucleoplasm, not inside the nucleus. And here, information in RNA is converted into a protein. So what's the building block of RNA again?
Nucleotide.
Sorry, this is getting a little boring, but I think it's really instructive. So we got nucleotides here. What about protein? What's the building block? Amino acid. So you're going from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language. What do you call that process when you take information and you convert it from one language to another? That's translation. So really it makes perfect sense to name these things transcription and translation, because that's really what's going on inside the cell. All right, so give me an example of translation. Like I could say, oh, hi, good morning. What would you tell me then if you're going to translate that? You mean we only know English in here? Yeah, but that's English. You would have to do what? Say, oh, hi, good morning. Say it in some other language. Who knows another language? Ah, yeah, Guten Tag. That's German. Okay. All right, so I'm sure we all know more than just English in here, right? So translation goes from... It's the same meaning, but it goes from one language to another. Translation. Okay. All right, so you got to know where transcription takes place, translation takes place, and what molecules are being converted from one to the other. And, for instance, when a protein is used to make RNA, what do we call that? That's a really nasty trick question. Okay. When we have a protein and we use it to make RNA, what process do we call that?
Nothing.
That can't happen, right? Smile. That wasn't that bad. I was trying to trick you. Because it can't go back. Look at that arrow right there. Protein can't be used to make RNA. RNA can only be used to make a protein. That's what we call that central dogma of biology. Okay. So I think that's what I would like for you to know about protein synthesis. How many steps does it require?
Two.
And you got to know the names of the two, where they take place. And this is an active process. This definitely requires ATP. Okay. And that we got these three different kinds of RNA that are made in the nucleus. But this RNA can't stay in the nucleus to make a protein. They've got to leave, right, to the nucleus. And don't forget, it's a one-way process to do that. Protein cannot be used to make DNA. Okay, so let's switch topics a little bit now from protein synthesis. We're going to talk about cell division. Cell division. And there are different ways that cells can divide. But this is the first way that we're going to look at cell division. Cell division, we're going to start with one cell right here. And that cell is going to grow and grow and grow. And then it's going to divide. And it's going to produce two cells. So it never divides to produce three cells or four or 20 or whatever. A cell will always divide in half. That's always how it goes. So we end up with two cells. This cell right here is what we call a parent cell. This is the parent cell. And does anybody know how many chromosomes are in a human cell? A lot. There's quite a few. There are 46. There are 46. There's 46 chromosomes. All right. But it has a special arrangement. It's not just 46, but it's actually two sets of chromosomes. So you have a number 1, a number 2, a number 3, all the way down to a number 23. And then you got another set. Ooh, let's try a different color. A number 1, does it look different to you? Doesn't look different to me. 3. Down to number 23 over here, that should be red. Right, so you have actually two sets of chromosomes. Number one is going to be very similar to this number one over here. The number two is going to be different than number one, but it's going to be similar to the number two over here. So where do you get these two sets of chromosomes from? From your parents. Right, so these, this first set, let's say, we can just pick somebody. So let's say mom. These are the chromosomes you get from your mom. And these chromosomes over here, you get from your dad. So that we call those papa chromosomes. No, those are paternal, right? And these are maternal. So you get a whole set of chromosomes, one set from your mom, one set from your dad. They come together and you have them in a cell. So this is a parent cell. But through this process of forming, going through cell division, okay, you end up with daughter cells. So here's a daughter cell, and here's a daughter cell. And guess what? You have two sets of chromosomes in these cells, like this. A 1, 2, 3, all the way down to number 23. And here's the same 1, 2, 3, down to 23. Then you got another set, 1, 2, 3, down to 23, and another one down here in the second daughter cell, all the way to 23. All right, so when you look at these two daughter cells, how could you describe the difference between these daughter cells as I drew it on the board? You can't. They look the same, right? So daughter cells are the same. There's no difference. And if you look at a daughter cell and you compare it to the parent cell, how does it look? It looks the same, right? So both daughter cells are identical to the parent cell. And of course, the parent cells are identical to these daughter cells right here. This kind of cell reproduction happens through a process that we call mitosis. And in science fiction, if you create the same cells, identical cells, over and over and over again, then we say, well, that's a clone, right? So you could think of mitosis as like being a process for cloning, producing the same cells over and over and over again. Okay? So daughter cells are clones of each other, basically, and also the parent cell. There should be no change. All right, so why do you think your body needs to do that? Why does your body need to make identical cells over and over and over again? Okay, so this kind of looks, this looks like reproduction. And it's reproduction, it's reproducing new cells, but that's not a good description. That's not a good description for mitosis, why it happens. Somebody said why. Oh, that's really good. So not just reproduction, because mitosis is reproduction. You're just using a different word to define that process. That's not really helpful. But, for instance, the cells on our skin that we're looking at right now are dead. They've come from a deeper layer and they've moved up to the surface. And we're losing those cells all the time. They're made to slough off. They're made to be rubbed off by clothing and things we bump into. But the living cells that are underneath it replace those that get bumped off. Okay? So one purpose of mitosis is to, so one purpose would be to replace old or dead cells in our body. Another really good example reason for mitosis would be our red blood cells that we find in blood. Red blood cells carry oxygen, and they don't live very long. They only live for about 120 days. That's really short, and then they die. So does anybody know how many red blood cells die every second in your body? A lot. But how big is a lot? A lot is phenomenal. It's 2.5 to 3 million cells. Every second, red blood cells die in your body. So, what do you, so how many red blood cells does your body have to build every second? 2.5 to 3 million every second, because if it doesn't, what disease do you have? Then you have, yeah, everybody probably knows this, you have anemia, right? You don't want to have anemia because you'll be fatigued and tired and all that kind of stuff. So your body has to replace all those dead and damaged cells Right, so mitosis is very important for replacing those red blood cells. That's one reason. Another reason is, number two, okay, at one point in time, you all were a zygote. Okay, I don't think you know what a zygote is. Doesn't sound very flattering. Okay, I suppose you could call your brother or sister that if you don't like them at some point in time. Okay, but if we have... if we have this cell right here, what does that look like? Sperm. All right, so that's from your dad, and here is an egg from your mom. And these two join together at some point in time. What do we call that process? I know I should sell these diagrams. Egg. 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 Okay, that process is what we call what? Fertilization. All right, and so here you have a sperm and egg. They're going to fuse together, right, to bring each one of these sets of chromosomes in here, and it's going to form one cell. And that one cell is what we call a zygote. And you were all a zygote. Even if you don't have a mom and dad today, you had a mom and dad someplace way back when, okay? And you were a zygote. But if you're just a zygote, you couldn't come to class and take notes or look around or nothing, right? Because you're just a single cell. I'm not trying to make fun of a zygote. That's pretty important because we all were a zygote at one time, right? So how did you get from being a zygote to somebody that can come to class and take notes and, you know, shoot pool and all that kind of stuff that you would like to do? You have to grow, right? So growth is another important reason for mitosis, right? To go from one cell to trillions of cells, you need mitosis because you need to get big. You need to grow up, and mitosis allows that to happen. Okay. So here you got a parent cell, here you got two daughter cells. What's the difference between these daughter cells?
Nothing.
Nothing. Should be the same as that parent cell. What's that process of going from parent cell to these two daughter cells? That's mitosis right there. Right? Okay. And now you know two really good reasons. Now, because these daughter cells are the same, right? It's a form of reproduction, but it's kind of a generic form of reproduction. And that kind of reproduction that produces the same thing over and over again is what we call asexual reproduction. Asexual reproduction. It's not sexual reproduction. Okay, so you were reproduced at one time, but was that asexual reproduction? Are you exactly like your parents? No. As a matter of fact, if you look around the room, do you see anybody else like you in the room? No. Sexual reproduction. Sexual reproduction. I'm usually not embarrassed by this stuff. Sexual reproduction produces what? Something different all the time, something new. That's the whole purpose of sexual reproduction. That's a different kind of reproduction than mitosis. Mitosis is asexual reproduction, produces the same thing over and over again. All right. So now you're really interested in learning something about mitosis, right? So its growth is real important because we don't want to be a zygote our whole life and replace old and damaged cells. Here are some five phases of the cell cycle. And these here, these bottom four, are active mitosis. That's active mitosis. How are we doing for time? Oh, we got some time. This first phase of the cell cycle is a growth phase. Because if in this parent cell we have 46 chromosomes, and then in these daughter cells we've got 46 and 46, how is it that we can split these chromosomes up but still end up with what we started with? We first have to duplicate these chromosomes so that every cell that develops from this parent cell gets one copy. Right? If we were to divide this in half, these would end up with what? Just 23 chromosomes. So we got to double these chromosomes so that when we split them in half, both daughter cells get 46. Plus, if this cell over here has one mitochondria, what would we like to have in these other daughter cells? Mitochondria as well, too, right? So mitochondria have to reproduce themselves. And Golgi bodies and endoplasmic reticulum have to reproduce themselves. So when the cell splits, both daughter cells are get some of the cytoplasm, the same thing that the parent cell has. And that happens during which phase? Interphase right here. That's a growth phase. So that's not a phase of the cell splitting or reproducing. That's just a growth phase where things are doubled inside the cell. Okay. And then we have active mitosis. Where are the pictures of mitosis? Here we go. This is like one of the last things in the chapter. All right, so here is a really good picture that's in your book, but it's a little bit more complicated than what I really want you to learn. So I'll tell you what I want you to appreciate on this slide right here. Okay, so mitosis, active cell division, is characterized by these four phases right here, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. The rest of the cell cycle is what we call interphase, and interphase is, how would you characterize interphase again? It's a growth phase. It's a phase getting ready for mitosis, but it's not active mitosis. So I don't want you to know G1 or S or G2. That's a little bit too complicated. Just know that this is interphase and it is a growth phase. If you're interested to know what's happening in these different growth phases, that's cool. Okay, but I won't test you on it because we only have so much time in class. What I want to really focus on are these four phases of mitosis. That is what? Active cell division. All right, so what's happening during active cell division? During interphase, the chromosomes are duplicated. But when the cell is ready to divide, all right, so here is a cell that's ready to divide. I see the nucleus. Can you see the nucleus?
Yeah.
It's a little bit small. And inside the nucleus, I see, some stuff, but it's not very clear. All right, that's chromatin. It's not really condensed into chromosomes. They're not discrete objects that I can see inside the nucleus. But I see some DNA in there. Right? In prophase, what happens to all of this DNA material, it condenses to form chromosomes. Can you see almost something that looks like a structure inside the cell right there? Little darker structures. But if we look at the illustration, right here is just chromatin all over the nucleus. But now in prophase, all that material condenses into discrete chromosomes that you can actually see underneath a light microscope. You can see that with a light microscope. So that's one thing that happens. The DNA condenses into chromosomes, at which point it can't be used for DNA synthesis anymore. It's in a form that's very protected, and it can't be used by the cell at all. But since the DNA is protected, then the nuclear membrane can dissolve away. So here, do you see a nuclear membrane anywhere on this one down here? No nuclear membrane. And look at the chromosomes. They're just what? Floating around inside the cytoplasm. And the DNA that makes up these chromosomes could be damaged, but since it's packaged really nice and tightly into these chromosomes right here, it isn't. So it's in a safe form. So that's the two things that happen during prophase. The DNA condenses into chromosomes, and then the nuclear envelope disappears. That's some pretty important bullet points. Okay, the other thing that happens, there are those centrioles move to either side of the cell, and I can see a pair of centrioles there and a pair of centrioles here, and the job of the centrioles is to what? Build and coordinate the microtubule system inside the cell. And we can see a bunch of microtubules moving from either pair of centrioles. Here's a good question. How did we get now two pairs of centrioles instead of one pair? What phase of the cell cycle did we end up with two pairs?
Interphase.
That would be the growth phase, which is interphase, right? So interphase, we duplicate the centrioles. So now on either side of the cell, we have two over here and two over here. And they control these microtubules, the filaments inside the cell, and they attach to these chromosomes right smack in the middle. That middle part is what we call a centromere. And they start to push and pull these chromosomes so that they line up right in the center of the cell right here. So that's the second phase of mitosis. And we call that metaphase. So metaphase is when the chromosomes line up right in the middle of the cell. Guess what metaphase means?
Middle.
Middle phase. Yeah, it's the same thing. All right, so there's not a lot of description about metaphase right here. It's just when the chromosomes all just line up in the middle. And if you look underneath a microscope, you can see it really nicely. That's metaphase. All the chromosomes are lined up. The next phase, notice that the duplicated chromosomes that were attached on this centromere right here start to be pulled apart. Those microtubules are pulling them apart. This is what we call anaphase. So anaphase is a phase that separates what we call these sister chromatids. It separates the sister chromatids, and these chromosomes are pulled to either end of the cell, either pole of the cell. And when they reach either end of the cell, then the nuclear envelope starts to reform on those two sets of chromosomes, and the cell starts to pinch apart, and the organelles are separated into two little pockets right here. So this is what we call telophase. Telophase is when the chromosomes are pulled way in opposite ends of the cell, and it starts to pinch apart, and the nuclear envelope starts to reform around it. And eventually, so here's a nice depression between these two cells. That's what we call a cleavage furrow. So there's a furrow or a depression between these two buds of cells that are forming. And eventually that buds the cells completely apart, and you end up with these two, what? What are these two cells called? Daughter cells, right? These two daughter cells. All right, so we got prophase, where chromosomes condense and the nuclear envelope disappears and the centrioles move to either side of the cell. We call that the spindle apparatus because it kind of looks like a little spindle apparatus with these microtubules right here. That's prophase. Metaphase, the chromosomes are right in the middle of the cell. Anaphase, the sister chromatids start to separate. And then during telophase, the cell splits in two and the nuclear envelope reforms once again, and you end up with what? Two cells right here. So that's the whole cell cycle, including active cell division. Now this process right here of making this cleavage furrow and separating these organelles into two separate cells, that happens during telophase, but that process is so important we give it another name. We call that cytokinesis. Cyto means cell, and kinesis means moving the cell components around. So this is moving the Golgi apparatus, right, and the endoplasmic reticulum and all that into two separate cells. That's cytokinesis. And in this class, what phase of mitosis does cytokinesis take place? Then during telophase, right? So just say cytokinesis happens during telophase. That might not happen exactly that way in all cells all the time. And I'm sure scientists are going to be talking for the next 100 or 200 years when cytokinesis happens. Some people are going to say, well, it happens a little bit in anaphase, you know, and then telophase. Or some people will say, well, not really anaphase, maybe a little bit of this phase right here. But for this class, when does cytokinesis take place?
Telophase.
Okay, that would be the correct answer. Okay. Who's got a question on mitosis? What kind of reproduction is it? Asexual reproduction. Right. All right. Guess what? I'll be able to finish this chapter today. All right. So you might be wondering, all the cells in my body don't look identical. Right? Because you have some skin cells. You got some cells in your eyeball that you can see. You can look at your tongue. Some cells in your mouth and your teeth. And your teeth don't look anything like your skin. Right? So something has to change with these different cells. They're not always exactly identical like what I told you here. And so there's another process that I want you to be aware of. So So not only is mitosis important, but there is another process that's important too that's related to mitosis. So here is one cell, and this cell right here we're going to call a stem cell. And a stem cell is interesting because they can become any part of your body. A stem cell can become a muscle cell, or a stem cell might become a nerve cell, for instance. What else do we have? Skin, or bone, or blood. And as a matter of fact, there's almost only one cell that can become any one of these things. And guess what the name of that cell was? That was a zygote. Okay? That single cell, product of fertilization, can become any cell in your body, right? Because otherwise you wouldn't have your body if it couldn't become everything in your body. So this process of a stem cell becoming a specialized tissue in your body, we call this differentiation. I kind of ran out of board right there. Differentiation. And that's a real important process. Okay, so here's differentiation. Because once a cell has become specialized to be a blood cell, it can never be converted into bone. And once something's bone, can't be converted into nerve. Right? And once something's a nerve, can't be converted into skin. And as a matter of fact, this nerve cell can't go back to becoming a stem cell. Because if it did, then it could be converted to something else. Right? So, differentiation, is that a one-way street or is that a two-directional street? It's one way. Once something becomes differentiated, those cells can only live their life with those particular functions. And this is real important because every once in a while we damage, for instance, some nerves that can't replace themselves due to mitosis. There are cells in our spinal cord that are nerve cells that once they're damaged and die, they can't be replaced. At least we haven't figured out how to do that yet. Okay, and then if somebody damages their spinal cord, then they're what? Paralyzed for the rest of their life, unfortunately, because your body doesn't know how to repair that damage, and we don't know how to repair it either with medicine at this point in time. But that's what the interest of stem cell research is, because maybe we can find stem cells that can rebuild those nerve cells in people that are paralyzed, and then they would be able to have maybe a normal life again. So that's pretty important to know how to do that. So don't forget, differentiation is an irreversible process, and differentiation will produce different cells in the body, and they have a different shape. And if they have a different shape, guess what? Their function is different as well. Right? So there's always a relationship between structure and function. Like this one is really long. It can send electrical signals long distances. That would be an example of a nerve cell. Okay. So probably a really good place to get stem cells is from an individual who's really small, like an embryo, because they're not completely differentiated yet. There are places in an embryo that can become nerve, bone, and blood. Maybe not everything, but a whole group of different kinds of tissues. And we can take those cells and grow them in culture or a test tube or a petri dish or something and build parts of a human body that can be transplanted in somebody else. Maybe another good example is, for instance, diabetes mellitus. Anybody know what diabetes mellitus is? Diabetes? Diabetes is a condition that some people have, unfortunately, where they cannot regulate their blood glucose levels. It goes up and down, and they can go into coma or death, but it produces a lot of other kinds of diseases in their body as they get older, heart disease, and people go blind and kidney failure. So it's really a really difficult disease. It can be horrible if it's not controlled or treated by people. And the hormone that controls blood glucose comes from the pancreas. And so people, one form of the disease is with people that don't have a pancreas that's functioning correctly. But what if we could get stem cells and rebuild a pancreas for them and transplant it in them, and then we could cure diabetes as a result of that. So that's really kind of a nice technique. That's the hope of stem cell research, right? But if the only place where you can get stem cells is from an embryo, that in the views of some people is really terrible, because when you get those stem cells from an embryo, guess what you do to the embryo? You kill the embryo. It dies. And what is the embryo eventually going to grow into? Yeah, a human being, right? So is an embryo alive? Obviously, otherwise you wouldn't even be interested in those cells, because you want to transplant living cells, not dead cells, into somebody. And, I mean, is it like plant life or animal life? It's what? It's human life. So it's really kind of special. So that's the dilemma that people have to face and come to grips with. Is it more important to save human life in the form of this embryo that some people think is not really a human yet? Or is it really important to be able to cure these really terrible diseases? It's a big dilemma, but I think I have a little solution to that. Yeah.
How far in the pregnancy can you still get the stem cells? Is it until birth, or?
You know, that's a really good question. There's three main levels of stem cells. The only cell that can become anything basically is a zygote. We call that totipotent. Okay. But here's kind of a nice resolution to this. With our level of understanding, we need embryonic stem cells. Right, but we're learning more and more where we have stem cells in our body, and it's kind of a nice discovery. Right, but they have very little potential. There are many different kinds of blood cells, and we found where there's a stem cell that can become any one of those different kinds of blood cells. So if somebody has a problem with their blood, we can just use those stem cells. And we've learned that there are stem cells in skin. So if somebody has a problem with their blood, we can't use those to cure blood, but we can use those to, maybe if somebody has a burn or something, we can use those to grow cells so that they can have an autograft, right? So that's really good. We'll probably learn where different stem cells are in even the adult body. We call those adult stem cells that can be harvested and used to grow an organ for that individual, right? But that's just going to take time to do that. And when we do that, then we don't have to kill embryos. But there's even a better reason why. Because if you get tissue from another person and we put it in your body, what's going to happen to it? It's going to be rejected, unless you take pharmaceutical agents to block that rejection. But then you're always going to be susceptible to infection and other kinds of things, right? But if we get stem cells, even if they're just partial stem cells, and we grow an organ from those stem cells that come from your body and put it back in your body, what about rejection? It's not a problem, right? So adult stem cells really will simplify this to a great degree, as long as we can figure out where those stem cells are. And we're learning all the time where different stem cells are. Okay, so that's pretty cool. All right. So I guess I'd like to keep talking, but that would jip you out of earning some points in the class. So I'm going to pass the quiz out.